This is Winston Churchill, speaking to you from number 10 Downing Street. Nothing lifts my spirits like a blast of Professor Buzzkill during our darkest hour. He busts myths and takes names like a squadron of Spitfires strafing enemy positions. And I'm totally stoked that he's here again to save Western civilization. So relax with your favorite whiskey and become enlightened.
Yes, Buzzkillers, it's Professor Buzzkill here, your favorite professor on the internets. But fortunately, there are so many wonderful real professors out there in the world. And today we have with us Dr. Julia Gottlieb, professor in modern history at the University of Sheffield, an expert in 20th century British political history and women's history, here to talk to us about guilty women, foreign policy, and appeasement in interwar Britain. Welcome to the show.
It's great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you, and I'm glad that we could make the connection across the Atlantic. I find this book so important, and it has broadened my view of what was going on in the 1930s in Britain and the way appeasement has been, you know, sort of mansplained to us over the decades, because it's all about Chamberlain and it's all about Churchill and it's all about meeting with Hitler and all about you hardly ever hear anything else. And certainly in the popular mind, I think not only the gender aspects of popular reception and popular politics in Britain, but also just this the sheer public opinion things aren't reported as often as they should be.
Yeah, that was what motivated me in the first place, and that was the starting point. I was looking to bring into convergence two really dominant and looming questions in the history and historiography of the interwar period. One is, what happens to women after the vote is won? How do they behave politically? How is politics feminized? How do they become politicized in the aftermath of suffrage? And that is a question that has, you know, been of fundamental interest to gender historians, women's historians, and more in the last 20 years to political historians who have kind of taken gender on board. That has never, though, been associated with the next, you know, major problem and major, you know, source of crisis of the interwar period, and that's the international dimension.
Yeah.
And British foreign policy and diplomacy. Having looked at the history of fascism in the project before this, you know, I was very aware how these international issues really, you know, exercised the imagination and were, you know, of central concern to, you know, those politically engaged in this period. So it was bringing these two questions together, trying to explain Britain's foreign policy decisions in light of the changing gender order.
Right. Because we should remind the Buzzkillers that, of course, female suffrage in Britain starts to happen in the 1920s, and in I think more than one stage, right? Married women, then all women.
You're almost there.
So sorry. Well, what happened? I'm a 19th century person, so I have to.
That's good. I'll drag you into the kicking and screaming into the 20th century then. So in 1918, we have the Representation of the People Act,
right,
which does, as you say, it's gender differential. So men achieve universal suffrage, but women are enfranchised only over the age of 30 and with certain property qualifications. However, it still means that over 8 million women are enfranchised. So
wow.
It's pretty momentous nonetheless. However, one of the real fears there was that, because, you know, many men had been lost in the war, etc., that women would outnumber men at the polls. And this was some anxiety that had to be assuaged by creating this, you know, two-tiered system. However, it takes 10 years for universal suffrage to be achieved. So in 1928, we have the Equal Franchise Act, also nicknamed the Flapper's Vote.
Yeah.
And then we have equal suffrage. But still, it's a huge sea change.
Yes, yes.
In the constitution of the political nation.
So by the mid-30s, this is sort of this new political nation, and as you say, constituted in a different way, is still kind of new. By the time international tension starts to break out in 1935, you have people who have only been active, at least in a ballot box situation, for less than 10 years.
Yes, and you see political parties kind of scrambling to how to respond to, how to attract, how to appeal, how to mobilize this massive female electorate. And naturally, politics, political appeals, policy, it changes, you know, significantly because of the concerns about what's going to happen at the ballot box as they try to appeal to women. And this has, you know, indelible impact on the framing of foreign policy. And that's why I think appeasement itself is largely symptomatic, or at least partly symptomatic. Again, something not acknowledged almost at all by any of the, you know, the scholarship up to, you know, of the past. You know, there is the concern amongst politicians to appeal to the women electorate, and you don't appeal to women by pursuing a bellicose or an aggressive foreign policy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, Professor, the thing that attracts so many British historians to this book is, at the very least, the great title, Guilty Women. Will you explain the background to this? Because our listeners won't know about what, frankly, is Guilty Men.
You know, it wasn't just that I wanted a sensational title that would be eye-catching and kind of clickbait, as we might say today. It is historically grounded in two ways. First of all, I wish it was my title, but it's not. It's an appropriation, and that's why it's in inverted commas. It's an appropriation of a text published in 1941 by a mysterious journalist, we can come back to that maybe a little bit later, called Richard Baxter, who writes this kind of 100-page tract called Guilty Women. Mm-hmm. It's covered in red. The paper is kind of rationed newsprint. And of course, what Richard Baxter was responding to, and what he probably and almost certainly wanted to achieve, was to create some kind of sequel, both in terms of content, but also in terms of the success of the tract Guilty Men, which was published in July 1940. You know, we've just passed the anniversary, the 80th anniversary of the publication of Guilty Men. So Guilty Men is really the cornerstone of the anti-appeasement stance. It was published in July 1940, just after Dunkirk, by three journalists. The most prominent amongst them was Michael Foot, who would later become leader of the Labour Party. And it was a complete indictment of the national government, of Chamberlain, and before Chamberlain, of Baldwin, and even Macdonald, who were prime ministers before. And it was trying to find out why Britain had landed in this position it found itself in the war. And at the end, mm-hmm. when the phony war had finally come to an end, it was trying to find those who were guilty, who were to blame for Britain's unpreparedness for war. And of course, it was about men. And it took as its cast of characters, all the prominent male politicians of the day. It completely, like so much other high politics history, wrote out women. My concern was to correct this view of Guilty Men in many ways, but not because I wanted to celebrate women, but I wanted to make sure that women were put back in the story,
right,
and that they weren't completely disenfranchised from one of the most pressing crises in Britain's national history. On the other hand, we have this book, Guilty Women, by Richard Baxter, which was also an indictment, but a very strange one, an indictment against so many women. So Richard Baxter's book was his attempt to identify those women who he accused of bringing Britain to the brink of national annihilation. It was part of the fifth columnist scare. And he was looking for the women who were responsible, who had worked behind the scenes, not only to support the policy of appeasement, but even more so, women who were spies, who were the heads of spy rings. And he spent a lot of time on two women in particular. One was Gertrude Schultz-Klink, who was the Nazi women's leader, and who very, very oddly came to Britain for a planned visit in March 1939, as late as that.
Wow.
And again, this had been pretty much ignored by historians as kind of irrelevant. Although she came and she was celebrated, she was welcomed with open arms by people from across the political spectrum. Okay, mainly those on the British right and, you know, within the conservative establishment. She was given a dinner hosted by the Anglo-German Fellowship, you know, all the people who were, you know, the arch appeasers definitely embraced her. She was in no way considered a pariah figure. And, you know, it was an important diplomatic event. Okay, soft diplomacy, soft power, right. but nonetheless one that went completely unnoticed by historians of foreign policy until quite recently. I wrote an article with the German historian Matthew Stibbe about that visit, and he found really fascinating things in the German archive to make us understand, you know, why she came for this visit at all. So Baxter spends a lot of time thinking about Gertrude Schultz Klink and how she's actually, what she actually came for. That was his accusation that she came to set up a spy ring by placing German domestics in British homes, and especially in the homes of those in power, to try to, you know, extract information and send intelligence home. Now that it's a fantasy. And much of what Richard Baxter writes about is a fantasy. The other person he's really interested in is someone called Stephanie Hohenlohe, Princess Stephanie Hohenlohe, yeah. who was an Austrian who had already made her way into Nazi circles and was a friend and confidant of Hitler's, and who had also become a great friend and collaborator and probably lover of Lord Rothermere, the owner and operator of the Daily Mail. Mm-hmm. So he was really fixates on women like that. But he also, and you know, women like that were, you know, indeed, you know, they were causing trouble, and they were guilty women. But he also talks more importantly and insinuates a much wider swathe of British women into this kind of guilty women category. And he more or less is concerned about how women have been responsible for kind of the peace pulse, for advocating, you know, a policy of peace and pacifism throughout the 1930s. And that it's that female instinct to mm-hmm. nurture, I mean, you know, to protect women, children, husbands, sons, that has brought Britain to this terrible place of kind of cowardice and unpreparedness.
So is it just appeasement, or is there a sort of broader attention being paid to what you might call gender and British foreign policy in the mid-30s?
Yeah, it's not just appeasement. And of course, what we find is that there's a real change in attitudes towards foreign policy more generally, mm-hmm. starting from the 1920s. And again, this is intertwined with women's politicization and women's, you know, greater political engagement. From the 1920s, you know, right after the First World War, there is a general movement represented by organizations like the League of Nations Union to democratize foreign policy. Because of course, you know, the First World War has seen, or the Great War at that time, is seen to have been caused by a lot of behind the scenes machinations and the, you know, the absence of any consensus or democratic process. So what we have is that, you know, in the 1920s and forward, women become invested in this, in kind of a you know, extra parliamentary politics around issues of foreign policy.
And of course, we should remind the Buzzkillers that by extra parliamentary processes, you mean processes and ways of doing politics outside the actual legislature. But apart from the sort of German/Italian/European problem, or mounting or gathering storm, as you know who calls it, what other sorts of foreign policy things seem to have different gendered reactions?
Of course, the peace movement is very popular in Britain in the 1920s right. and 1930s. And the peace movement was dominated by men. But of course, and that was seen as very important too. I mean, if you look at an organization like the Peace Pledge Union, founded by Reverend Dick Shepherd, at first he only wanted to recruit men. Mm-hmm. He wanted the pledgers to be men because it was seen as too obvious that women would support such a movement.
Oh, right.
And if the movement was going to have any power and any clout, any influence, it had to be shown that it was men that supported it, and that men were not going to fight. Nobody cared if women didn't fight, women weren't enlisted. So that is, I think, a really important point. And that, you know, in a way, women were, you know, taken for their support for peace policy was taken for granted, whereas it was to turn men in support of pacifism. But then, of course, the whole pacifist movement comes to crisis point in the mid-1930s. The Spanish Civil mm-hmm. War represents an important turning point. We have just before that in 1935, the peace ballot, which was, you know, organized by the aforementioned League of Nations Union. And here, you know, you have, you know, a joint cross-sex effort to clarify that public opinion is largely in support of measures that will later be called measures of appeasement, collective security, right, and ways of, any way possible to avert war, even in the face of Nazism. Now that these arguments become more and more tenable as the 1930s march along, and many, many people experience some kind of conversion in the course of the 1930s. Oh. Again, the Spanish Civil War is an important turning point. For some, it's even earlier, Abyssinia the year before. Others, it will be Munich itself, the Munich crisis, mm-hmm. and the betrayal of the Czechs. And that, a lot of women too, who had been wholehearted pacifists, have this moment of conversion where they realize that you cannot, that there's a fundamental contradiction between being anti-war and anti-fascist. You can't be both. Right. You have to fight fascism on its own terms, and its own terms are the terms of war. And this is a heartfelt and a very, significant and painful dilemma for many of the figures in my book, in Guilty Women, who, have to come to this realization. And they do so at, in different, different stories have, have different set of events that lead to this conversion. So we have figures who very early on, realize that they can't be both anti-war and anti-fascist, like, Ellen Wilkinson being a really good example. In fact, Ellen Wilkinson is one of the only women that Richard Baxter in Guilty Women lets off the hook and actually sees as a not guilty woman. Uh-huh. And he sees her as a very heroic figure. She was, of course, a pioneering labor woman MP, much more on the far left. She's also very famous for leading the Jarrow marchers, the hunger marchers. Oh, yeah. So we have those. And then we have a lot of women, as I say, who come to this realization slowly and at different stages. So a number of women writers like Margaret Storm Jameson, Maud Royden, who's another famous figure. And then there are women who never come to this realization and never, never let go of their pacifism. And their pacifism is absolute pacifism. So someone famous like Vera Brittain, right, who had written, of course, Testament of Youth. She was seen very much as the women's voice of that war generation. And she, carries on into the war. She's a, prominent member of the Peace Pledge Union. And she never relinquishes her commitment to absolute pacifism. Another figure who really fascinates me and who's all over Guilty Women, if you like, too, both because Guilty Women, tries to follow the trajectory of women's lives and their political engagement over 20, 30 or even 40 years. Another figure here that, that really fits into the story is Helena Swanick, who had been a suffragist, then a pacifist during the First World War. And then she also, she also cannot relinquish or turn away from her heartfelt and uncompromising pacifism, to the point where by the late 1930s, she's starting to be an apologist for Nazi Germany. Wow. Because she thinks nothing is worse than war. So this is an issue. Now, she's a really interesting segue to my current project, which grew out of Guilty Women. And because in November 1939, she's already in her mid to late 70s. She's spent all her life dedicated to, political feminist causes, to foreign policy, and to having a really independent voice on these issues. She is obviously in despair at the failure of her life's work. And tragically, in November 1939, she takes her own life.
Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness. What I'm getting from all of this is incredibly diverse and deep attention to foreign policy among not only these women's groups, but among people who are sort of watching or paying attention to what the women's groups are saying and prominent women are saying. But now things as 35, 36, 37, 38 are starting to grind along. We're getting more focused on what's going on with the Nazis and what's going on with Hitler. And I notice one of my favorite parts of the book is what you call when you start to work on conservative women's support for Chamberlain and appeasement. So what happens then?
The problem with the gaps in the study of women and politics in Britain has often been the Conservative Party, mm-hmm. and women's place in conservative politics. Now, we have to think about who's writing women's history. Usually it's women who come from a feminist activist stance, who are looking for the kind of their foremothers of right. their own politics. understandably been attracted to women who played prominent roles in suffrage movement, in progressive politics, as we would call it today, usually on the left. And this has meant that there's a real kind of blind spot when it comes to women in the Conservative Party, one that we're trying to fill in, thank goodness. And there's been, you know, really significant and important work on conservative women in the last, you know, 15, 20 years. But it's taken a long time. And there's lots of reasons for that, which we don't need to go into now. But when we start to look at conservative women, we realize where, you know, the power of the Conservative Party really lay. And the Conservative Party was deeply, deeply dependent on women's support, mm-hmm. not only at the ballot box, but there, of course, too. If you try to understand why the 20th century is the conservative century in British politics, we have to think about the way the Conservative Party has so successfully mobilized women.
Right.
This then relates to the other question, why appeasement? Why is it successful? Why is it popular? Well, the first place to look, or one of the obvious places to look, is the base level of women's support for Chamberlain in his own party. Uh-huh. And the kind of way that women underwrote the policy of appeasement gave Chamberlain on a personal level the confidence to think that he was doing the right thing. And it's interesting to look at what Chamberlain was reflecting on in those days and weeks around Munich. And one of the things that really struck me, I went to the Chamberlain archive, of course, and I was looking at, you know, for anything, you know, this was early on in the project. And what I immediately found, and that, you know, just it was amazing. There were these file upon file upon file of the crisis letters.
Ah.
All right. These are letters that were sent to Chamberlain and importantly to not only to Neville, but also to Mrs. Annie Chamberlain, his wife. Many of them were addressed to her. We can talk about why that's important too, which were full of praise and admiration and gratitude
right.
for this man of peace who has saved the world, who had saved the nation, saved the world from another, you know, a war of annihilation. Okay. Everybody receives letters or fan mm-hmm. mail or hate mm-hmm. mail. But the point was what Chamberlain did with that material. There are these files called the crisis letters. This doesn't appear in any other politician's
papers. No, I was going to say, yeah.
He collected these meticulously. He hired extra secretaries and secretarial staff to respond to these letters in the days and weeks around Munich. They put a lot of store in this marker, these measures, this expression of public opinion, and that at least that's what the Chamberlains wanted to see this material as the greatest kind of revelation of what public opinion was. And amongst these letters, there are at least half of them are from women.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a very famous statement that Chamberlain makes on the radio just before he goes to Munich, or just before he realizes he's being invited to Munich, where he says that there's no point, you know, why would the British Empire consider going to war over Czechoslovakia, a nation of which we know nothing.
Yeah.
Everyone focuses on that part of his broadcast. But just before he says that, he says that he knows that this is not worthwhile because of what he has found out, what he's been told through the letters written to him from women.
Oh, okay.
So it's pivotal in his thinking. It's pivotal in his emotional response, I would say, and in his psychological response to the policy and the political situation. So Chamberlain was already very popular with women. He had been, you know, Minister of Housing in the 1920s. He'd been Chancellor of the Exchequer. He was always seen as someone who was quite responsive to women's domestic concerns. And he took that popularity with women with him into, you know, his premiership and when, you know, everything changed and he suddenly, you know, this very domestic politician had to deal with this most pressing foreign policy crisis. And it comes through in so much of what he does. It comes through in those crisis letters. It comes through in newspapers. It comes through at Conservative Party meetings that are held in and around and after Munich, where every, you know, women's conservative association is just, you know, waiting anxiously to be able to thank him, to heap him with praise and love and admiration. And, you know, it's really striking. And somehow, again, you know, it has to explain to some extent why he takes the decisions he takes. You know, so again, when we put gender into the mix, we get a rather different understanding even of the guilty man.
What happens then when he gets back, we all know from the news clips and the things we've seen on him, you know, History Channel documentaries, he waves the, gets off the plane, waving the piece of paper, on and on and on. Is there such a thing as different gendered reactions to Munich, to what happened rather than the buildup?
Is it different? Well, it's different and similar, if you like.
Yeah.
That's kind of a question to answer. I mean, what is important is that the public reaction is feminized.
Huh.
All right. So the notion that what we have is as a reaction to both the Munich Agreement, but also to that Anglo-German Agreement, which is the piece of paper.
That's right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which is the deal that he makes, or the deal he thinks he's making with Hitler, that, you know, they will not go to war again, their two nations. In any case, what happens, as I say, in the popular press, even in the broadsheets as well, what you have is an idea that the behavior of the crowds is the hysterical female.
Ah.
And that there are individual hysterical females who are pulled out. But what happens is that there is this kind of this feminine, celebration of this great achievement. All right. So what we have then is that the crowd is feminized, and support for appeasement in general is kind of feminized. And this is played on a great deal by the anti-appeasers, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, too, who want to, you know, to start to spin their own narrative of the response to, you know, German aggression has to be a masculine response rather than a feminine.
Sure. Yeah.
And, you know, so Chamberlain is feminized in many ways by his opponents as well. And he's also, you know, feminized, but also aged, you know, the fact that he's an old man, he's turning 70 at that time,
right,
that he carries around this old umbrella. And I've written an article about Chamberlain's umbrella, in fact,
and the
various meanings that are attached to the umbrella, and also the material culture that develops around the umbrella, and the way that kind of the umbrella is accessorized and merchandised in those months after Munich. Interestingly, that merchandising, you know, little trinkets, little Chamberlain dolls, Chamberlain chocolates, which are of the umbrella and so forth, all of that, of course, is directed towards a female consumer base.
Right,
right,
right.
This is another way of showing that, you know, appeasement was being sold to women. And women are seen as the natural market, the natural consumers of the politics and the emotion of appeasement.
Well, you've pointed out to us that at the very least we need to have another show someday on Chamberlain's umbrella, because this is a perfect sort of eye catcher and ear catcher for listeners. And I can imagine a great YouTube video where if we can find as many of those artifacts as possible. But sort of to wrap up, well, not to wrap up, but to bring one final aspect into it. And that is, of course, this is an American show, or at least produced in the United States. And anytime we talk about British history, whether it's from the 7th century to the 20th century, we have to have our required Winston Churchill content in order for us to get any sort of support or sponsorship, ching, ching. So you have a very interesting section in the book called, now this is obviously different from the women and appeasers, the women Churchillians and the politics of shame. I found that phrase absolutely gripping.
Right. Well, thank you. And Churchill, you know, Churchill has to play a major role.
Right. Really, of course. Yeah.
And Churchill himself wasn't very interested in working with women in, mm-hmm, politics. I think there's been a recent study, in fact, of Churchill's kind of secretaries and the kind of the women who, you know, grouped around him and who supported him in those usually unacknowledged ways. But I'm not talking about them particularly. Okay, they're there. But I'm much more interested in a couple of women who he actually took quite seriously and he worked with in terms of his anti-appeasement agenda. The two or three women are Violet Bonham Carter, mm-hmm, who he went back a long way with, as we say. And she was a very, very vigorous voice against, you know, Chamberlain's foreign policy. She was a liberal and he took her, you know, quite seriously. And they worked together on various anti-fascist campaigns, kind of midstream anti-fascist campaigns. And they both, you know, advocated very strongly an alliance with Soviet Russia as a way of challenging German hegemony. And he worked also with the Duchess of Athol, reluctantly at first. Now, the Duchess of Athol is a very important figure in Guilty Women because she's one of the, again, the opposite of the Guilty Women. She was a conservative. She was the first woman cabinet minister, in fact, in the 1920s. And she was a conservative, though, but she took her own stand on foreign policy. She was a dissident. She was an anti-Chamberlainite. And that's because she had become an anti-fascist. Again, it was the Abyssinia and then the Spanish Civil War that opened her eyes to the dangers of fascism and how that had to become the priority for all else. And she forced a by-election in her constituency, December 1938. And she staked it all on, standing on an anti-Chamberlain ticket. She didn't have to, that she called this by-election for herself by having to, because she had to resign and stand as an independent. And she lost, and she had been in contact with Churchill for years already. They had actually been allies since the early 1930s on a totally different and in many ways completely contrasting cause, which was, the India Act. She had been very reactionary with Churchill on the question of empire. But then they took the same journey from that kind of, radical right reactionary position on that question to something very radical, almost leftist in their opposition to fascism. Now, Churchill should have come and supported her during her by-election campaign, but he didn't. He was afraid that he would be deselected if he did. So he wasn't that brave in that respect. He wrote a bit about, in support of her in the press, but very, he made it clear that, sorry, I just can't risk it, even though I agree entirely with you. So in that story, he might not come out as a great, heroic figure. There was a good example of two women who he respected, who were allies and who were equals, I suppose. But generally, Churchill offers us a very different kind of idea of British national identity, of a gendered British national identity, which is quintessentially male, masculine, kind of the British bulldog, cigar chomping male. So it's a complicated and complex story. But the politics of shame. So where does that come in? Well, everyone is concerned with Britain's standing after the Munich Agreement. Some will see Britain and Chamberlain, of course, as the great saviors of peace, and then others feel deep, deep and penetrating shame for what Britain has done to a worthy ally. They've destroyed this great democratic dream in Central Europe. And Churchill in particular continually speaks about the shame of Munich.
Well, then, Professor, what you've presented here, and we should tell the Buzzkillers that there's so much more in the book, and that's why they should go to the Buzzkill bookshelf and get it, is that it's very, very complicated. The gender reactions to appeasement, either the pro-appeasers, the anti-appeasers, the female Churchillians, and on and on and on and on and on, thickens this story tremendously. And I think that not only do we get this sort of media reaction of it's all guilty men or non-guilty, guilty men on the one hand and Churchill on his own on the other hand, there are all of these other people involved.
Indeed. And I think another important thing that we can emphasize is the importance of the public.
Yeah.
The public, public opinion, and the fact that this isn't just, I've spoken quite a lot in this podcast about individuals, prominent individuals, but there's a whole swathe of the man in the street, the woman in the street, the ordinary person who is deeply, deeply affected and affected by the Munich crisis, by the policy of appeasement. And that's actually where you can find the women. And that's where I think we really need to make sure we bring gender into play, because everyone is deeply, deeply moved and affected by the crisis. Their lives are changed. And, this is a crisis that is political, international, but it's also a very personal crisis, or it leads to, it's inevitable that the crisis is internalized. I've talked a lot about the crisis letters already that Chamberlain receives, but we see a lot, a much wider kind of spectrum of response when we look at a source like Mass Observation, which I use a lot in the book.
Right, we've explained it in other shows,
Right. So Mass Observation, also has a really good balance, gender balance. So we hear a lot of women's voices through the Mass Observation, replies to directives, the diary entries. And here women are explaining, again, how the political situation is changing their lives, sometimes for the better. Sometimes they are quite inspired by the emergency, but more often they're really, you know, suffering from anxiety and fear of the future.
Well, Professor, it just remains for me to say thank you so much for coming on the show. You, with the book and with other work you've done, you certainly broadened my perspective and greatly broadened my understanding of this period and broadened my understanding of appeasement and non-appeasement. So, A, are you willing to come back and do an umbrella show someday in the future?
Especially on a rainy day.
And we'd like to have you back on the show to talk about, in general, these sorts of gendered reactions to different political things going on in this period. So again, thanks for coming on the show.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
And Buzzkillers, of course, go to the Buzzkill bookshelf, get Guilty Women. It's absolutely gripping and eye-opening. And we will talk to all of you out there next week.